Will be Ditch Digger Radio, Dr. Zom Stereo Obscura, and Pandemonium.
I beg your pardon.
And the Rockets, the Rockets.
And the other Rockets. Week, we'll be hosting Drinking from Puddles, Life During Wartime, and Heavy Metal Vomit Party. Wednesday nights, full of the great music programming you've come to expect here on KBOO Portland.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Also by Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver, available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. Stay tuned for the Recovery Zone.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. Today's guest is Stephen Herod Buhner, who is a senior researcher for the Foundation for Gaian Studies in New Mexico. He has been described as both an earth poet and a bardic naturalist, and has written over 19 books, including The Lost Language of Plants and Sacred Plant Medicine. His most recent book is called Plant Intelligence and the Imaginal Realm, Beyond the Doors of Perception into the Dreaming of the Earth. Using a lot of science, this book somehow, as one reviewer wrote, takes the reader right into the heart and soul of the world. And throughout, the case is made in this book that solving our problems isn't going to happen until we change our thinking. A quote, just to sort of give you another sense of the book: the 20th century was the great age of physics, and the 21st century is the age of biology. According to Stephen Herod Buhner, we must interact empathetically with the biosphere by opening our perceptual gates to perceive through all body sensations. He deliciously explores music, writing, art, and plants as tools for reclaiming our feeling sense of nature. Plant Intelligence and the Imaginal Realm is a work of heartfelt wisdom written so exquisitely that it took my breath away. A must-read for anyone who wants to achieve keystone intelligence, empathic immersion within Earth's dreaming. This was written by Barbara Hand Clow, who had written Awakening the Planetary Mind. So, Stephen, we have you on the phone, right?
Yes, you do.
Great. Okay, and you're from New Mexico. You're talking to us from there?
That's right.
Okay. Well, this book, it's nearly 500 pages, but I couldn't stop reading it. And by the time I put it down, I was actually almost kind of dizzy. It has such a broad sweep. But one of the things that just kept coming for me over and over through it, I mean, you quoted it over and over, this Einstein quote, that we can't solve our problems using the same kind of thinking that created them. And yet the problem seems to be that our culture doesn't want to let us extend our awareness further than the culture itself wants us to go. And that seems to be a big dilemma that was part of your book. And I was wondering if you could just start by talking about that.
It's a huge dilemma. And the thing is that once you really start getting into what the Earth really is, how Gaia really works, how ecosystems really work, how life forms interact, you start to find pretty soon into that process that the mechanicalist, reductionistic sort of perspective that we inherited from the late 19th century just, it has very little to do with the world. The problem is that sort of thinking has been in place for over a century now, and there's so many institutions and businesses and cultural beliefs that are centered in that kind of concept that for people to give it up, it basically means destructuring the entire cultural framework, the industrial framework, the education framework, everything. You know, it's sort of like we all go through this as people and as cultures. We get an idea about the way that the world works, and we sort of begin to base our life and our behavior on it. And when it starts to become clear to us that it's not accurate, it's extremely difficult to give those beliefs up because we have to sort of tear apart our worldview and bound down to the foundations and begin again. And most people just, it's too uncomfortable. They don't want to do it. And especially if their livelihoods are dependent on it, if their entire business framework is dependent on it. So we're sort of really stuck. People aren't really going to let that go. It's not going to be an easy transition. And just like for an individual, most of us change because the universe forces us to change, not because we go, hey, you know, I think changing is a great idea.
Right, right. And yet your book is filled with a lot of science, the first part of it, that kind of, if anybody actually reads it seriously, it seems like it would have to change minds, I mean, at least somewhat, because, for instance, you really talk about just basically Gaia as a sort of living being in such a way that you establish that there's intelligence, that there's communication. Could you just talk a little about that, like just how old she is and some of the reasons for believing that she's actually really conscious and alive and communicating and, you know, whatever?
Well, Gaia is, you know, the Earth is about 4.5 billion years old. And just to begin with, you know, people throw these numbers around. They don't really know. They're kind of educated guesses. You know, if they're off by 10 million years this way or that way, they don't really care. But, you know, Gaia's about, or the Earth itself is about 4.5 billion years old. And so somewhere between 500 million and a billion years into that, the Gaian network formed. And basically, the foundation of that is bacterial. There was a bacterial membrane that extended entirely around the Earth. And it's sort of, once it reached this certain kind of point, it's sort of self-organized into a superorganism. And so that kind of a belief system is extremely different than what we've inherited in schools. Like, we're basically taught that the Earth is this ball of resources hurtling around the sun. We're the only intelligent life form on it, and we can just pull resources out of that, the ecological matrix, indefinitely. But what happened in the 70s was James Lovelock, who was working for NASA at the time, they asked him, he was a planetary scientist in many different respects, but he wasn't limited by boundaries. He was more of a generalist, and he was working for NASA, and they wanted to find out if there was life on Mars. And kind of in the process of looking at that, he had this sort of epiphany, realized that oxygen is a very toxic, very reactive gas. It doesn't remain free in the atmosphere like it does on Earth. It tends to combine with other things and sort of disappear from the atmosphere. And he realized something must be artificially keeping the atmosphere filled with oxygen. And secondly, he realized the temperature dynamics that were happening across the Earth were very unusual. Most planets are either much hotter or much colder. And then he realized something must be keeping the temperature constant. And he began to realize that the Earth was acting as if it were a living organism that was maintaining its state through well, like our bodies do, that right. There was some sort of regulatory dynamic going on, and that one had to begin to look at the Earth as a living being if one wanted to understand how it was working. So he happened to live next door to William Golding, the author that wrote Lord of the Flies, and they were talking about it one day, and William Golding said, well, you know what you should do is you should call it Gaia, because that's the ancient Athenian word for the Earth goddess, the living Earth, and that really kind of captures what you're talking about. So he did that and immediately caused a firestorm of problems, because as soon as you use that word, then you start to have a sense of the earth as a living being, and it so contradicted everything else that he was bitterly attacked for decades.
Right, you're by personifying
scientists.
Yeah.
But really, they've been unable to undermine his work, and now they're just arguing about, you know, how aware is Gaia? Like, some people say, yeah, we need to treat the earth as if it's alive, but it's not really alive. And other people are saying, yeah, it is alive. So they're arguing about that now. But basically, his work is fairly well accepted at this point.
And one of the things that you got into, I mean, the whole bacteria part was fascinating, like that we are really only ourselves, our bodies are just, you know, complexes of one-celled organisms, that these one-celled organisms are working with hormones and things like and serotonin and stuff that they've been doing this forever. But I'd like to get to that too if we have time. But also the idea that plants themselves have set up these huge neural networks that are in a sense like our brains. But that they're communicating and working with each other in a way through their root systems. Could you talk about that just a minute?
Yeah, well, one of the things that's really kind of undermining the old reductionist frame of reference is spontaneous self-organization of life forms. And everybody likes to, you know, think physics is some sort of foundational thing, but what's also true is life forms spontaneously self-organize here. And Lynn Margulis was the person truly brilliant work, where she realized all life forms that we see are basically bacteria just in more complex forms through a thing that she called symbiogenesis, where, you know, unlike organisms blended together to create a third organism whose behavior and form couldn't be predicted from a study of the previous parts, and that really everything on Earth is just a form of bacteria. So the interesting thing is, when a self-organized biological organism, whether it's a virus or a bacteria, or it doesn't matter, a plant, any kind of self-organization of a life form occurs, a neural network also forms. And those neural networks, the organism has to be able to tell the difference between itself and other life forms. It has to be able to have a sense of its own integrity. It has to know when it's approached by other life forms whether their intent is hostile or not. And, you know, it has to determine the meaning, and it has to craft responses. And it turns out that when you really start looking at things the way they really are, you begin to find out that every life form that is possesses extreme intelligence, that they possess language, tool making, culture, a sense of self, and on and on and on. And so, you know, I've been looking at bacteria for over 20 years now, but plants equally as long. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff. There's a thing called brain chauvinism, where people are into, well, you know, we have to look at brain size and relation to body and all of that. But the thing is, our brain is an organ, and its only function is to hold the neural network that we think of as what produces intelligence. And when you pull that neural network out of the brain and you look at it, it's actually identical to the plant root system. And plant roots, you know, they're finding now, and which a lot of people have known for a long time, but finally sort of new generations of, you know, plant researchers are beginning to sort of break the old injunctions against talking about this stuff out loud. The root system has synapses exactly the same as we do. It has neurons exactly the same as we do. It has memory storage, everything. It uses the same neurotransmitters that we do. And one of the main differences is that plants, their root system, they use the soil as the organ which holds their neural net. We're limited by brain size. So when you start looking at plants, they're going to have a wide variety of neural network sizes, but there's a great many plants, like aspen groves, that literally their neural network covers several hundred acres and is up to 100,000 years old, that their neural network, their brain, is in fact far greater in size than our own and is far more able to engage in computing capacity that just simply dwarfs the human being. And the same is true actually of bacteria and the bacterial network communities that they form. So this really undermines the entire worldview that we're all, you know, immersed in from the moment that we were born, and even more so when we start school, that we're the only intelligent species. As a matter of fact, we're just kind of a Johnny-come-lately. These neural networks and intelligence dynamics and neurochemicals existed for hundreds of millions of years, if not billions of years, before human beings even showed up.
I just want to let listeners know you're tuned to KBOO Portland. This is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. And I'm talking with Stephen Herod Buhner, who's written a really fascinating book, Plant Intelligence and the Imaginal Realm, Beyond the Doors of Perception into the Dreaming of the Earth. And basically what you're saying brings a lot of humility, I think, to us as a species. I mean, plants might sort of figure that they've just got, like, you know, brains 10 times ours, you know, or something, or zillions, as you were saying. But also that the fact that they use the same hormones, serotonin was very interesting to me. You talked a lot about how it creates a sense of cooperation often, and that bacteria are using it, that plants use it, that it's been around forever, like the billions of years that life has been on this planet. Could you just talk a little about how that works and maybe bring in the whole idea of gating?
Well, serotonin is a really ancient molecule, and it's been around for a long time. And what serotonin, one of its primary functions is, it regulates the neural networks of the planet. And every neural network on the planet uses serotonin to modulate its function. So what happens, I mean, people sort of have a decent sense of how an immune system works, of how the immune system works in the human being. So if, you know, our immune system is a very self-organized, very highly intelligent subpart of our body, it thinks, it reasons, it does a lot of stuff, because when we're touched by something from the outside world, the immune system has to figure out what that thing is and what to do and how to respond, and it crafts responses. And if it wasn't highly intelligent and capable of generating responses like that, we'd all have been dead a long time ago. But it's the neural networks of the planet work very similarly. So when outside events, essentially meanings, we're bathed in flows of communications, of message material, as Gregory Bateson called it, and we encounter those all of the time. And every time we're touched by meanings, the meanings we're embedded in, because they're shifting in nature all of the time, then there's a response from our neural network. There's serotonin modulations that occur in response that basically alters the dynamic of our neural networks. So it's sort of a metamolecule for neural network functioning. And one of the things that happens is that that literally we're perceiving, like every life form is, every bit of sensory input that surrounds us, we're taking it in all of the time. That's trillions and trillions and trillions of bits of visual data and sound data and feeling data and taste and smell. And what happens is that we would be overwhelmed. We experience a kind of a cognitive fragmentation if we took it all in and if it wasn't sort of gated out. So, you know, Aldous Huxley came up. No, it was William Blake first, and Aldous Huxley popularized it, this term called my brain just went blank.
Perceptual gating.
The doors of perception,
yeah.
There it is. So a lot of neuropharmacologists that came along in the 60s altered that, and they called it sensory gating, doors of perception, sensory gating. It's a similar kind of thing. And what happens is there's various places in our neural network where there's, through a very sophisticated kind of analysis, different parts of our neural net in our brain, it gates out, it like removes a bunch of the data. It says it's flowing through our neural network, and there's probably 20 or 30, let's say, different gating places. And what finally gets to our conscious mind is just a tiny bit of all of the data that we're taking in. So it's gated out like that. And serotonin is one of the major molecules that acts to manipulate those gates to let more or less data in to our conscious awareness, and that's sort of how that works.
Yeah, and it was interesting that you had that Americans were sort of especially weird on the planet because we have maybe the least open gates of any other country, the least open processual gates, and we're sort of way more focusing on surfaces than like going into the depths of things, which happens when you open those gates. You were talking
right,
about
one
that.
Of the things that I mentioned, there's this great German poet, Gottfried Bain, who came up with this phrase called the metaphysical background of the world. And Americans, and also in the UK to a huge extent, it's common in the Western cultures, Australia, any place. But the UK and the United States are really the worst at it. And we're oriented towards surfaces. And it's very, very unusual for people to understand that beyond the surface of anything that you perceive, there's this metaphysical background that's very different than the surface we're looking at. That a chair is not just a chair, even though we define it as that by looking at its surface and its function, but there's literally feeling components of the chair itself which give access to its deeper dimensions. Basically, there's meanings that are put into the chair as it's being made that literally affect how people feel when they get around it. Everything has that sort of metaphysical dynamic behind it. And Americans are one of the very few cultures on the earth that don't have the general capacity to work with these deeper aesthetic dynamics of matter. I mean, we've just really lost our capacity, and part of what happens is to get us to surfaces is our sensory gating becomes very, very, very narrow. And that's one of the reasons that psychotropics had such a major impact in American culture in the 60s and 70s is that they function to open sensory gating channels extremely widely, and so that you begin to interact with the deeper meanings that are inherent in the world. And from that, you can move outside of habituated behaviors and innovate in ways that you just can't if you're oriented towards surfaces.
In fact, you talked about psychotropic plants as actually being like there's keystone animals like wolves and stuff that sort of the environment really needs. And psychotropic plants are a keystone plant species for plants, for all animals, not just humans.
Right. Because all neural networks are virtually identical, because they're all based, they all use serotonin as the primary modulator. When you get to serotoninergic, however that word is pronounced,
right.
My tongue is not working today. But basically, the alkaloids that act as psychotropics, they're modifications of serotonin molecules, and they very specifically open gates in the sensory network and the neural network very widely. And they do it in every organism that ingests them, whether it's a plant, a spider, a bear, it doesn't really matter. It does the same kind of function, and they act in specific ways in the neural network of the planet. They're designed to allow organisms to perceive deeper meanings in their environment and then to craft responses that are outside of their normal habituated parameters. And so it's a kind of a Gaian dynamic which allows tremendous innovation in response to environmental challenges.
And it's been around a long, long time. It didn't just sort of happen in the 60s. This has been going on, again, for billions of years, that Gaia has used this as a way to help itself survive, it sounds like.
Yeah, psychotropics have been around for hundreds of millions of years, and they have very specific roles in the ecosystem. So when you're talking about the drug war or something like that, you're really looking at two different categories of drugs. You're looking at the drugs that were naturally generated out of the environment, most of which have this kind of function. And then you're looking basically at drugs like cocaine or heroin or morphine or methamphetamines. Those are basically side effects of pharmaceutical medicine. That really, that part of the drug war is an iatrogenic disease, even though it's never recognized as such.
In other words, a doctor-made problem or a pharmacy-made problem.
It's a medical system-made problem.
Right.
And they do two different things. But, yeah, they've been around, psychotropics have been around for hundreds of millions of years, and they've been doing something all of that time besides pining for our emergence.
Right. And yet our emergence has been, that was a really interesting part of your book, too, that we're just a tiny bit. I mean, we, as human beings, especially with the civilization we've had, which is maybe 10,000 years old or something,
right,
where we've gotten domesticated, when you think of billions of years of life. But you have a nice way of sort of describing why people might be on this planet, too. And could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, I think all of us that care deeply for the Earth and are disturbed by the kind of ecological devastation that we encounter every day, that we feel is this tremendous impact on our hearts, and there's a kind of it puts people into shock in this certain kind of way, and as we become aware of it, you know, we start to try to deal with the enormity of the problem, and one of the early stages of that, in which I went through for many years myself, is that we begin to think of the human species as a cancer or a virus or a plague or something like that. And we kind of get into, it's a really kind of a form of self-hatred, and it's understandable. But nevertheless, I've been following this kind of path and doing this work for about 40 years now, and after a while, the deeper I got into understanding Gaia and function, it became clear Gaia does not make mistakes of that magnitude. You know, the real question, which oddly enough, no one had ever asked that I have ever read, and I read extensively, is what's the ecological function of the human species? You have to understand, within the Gaian frame, species don't just kind of emerge out of nowhere. That's that old kind of sort of neo-Darwinianist reductive thinking. It doesn't work that way. No species emerges except to fulfill specific ecological functions, and they're a Gaian expression that emerges out of the background ecology of the planet. So in looking at what's the function of human beings, if you recognize that Gaia doesn't make mistakes of that kind of magnitude, and you start looking at it with different eyes, then you have to begin to ask yourself, really, what's going on here? And it took me a lot of work to get to an answer that I think is useful. And essentially, what started me on it was really two comments. One was Richard Dawkins, a guy I really hate, who said, Gaia is not alive because Gaia does not reproduce. Now, the first thing that's weird about that is a guy that's only going to live to be about 80 years old is pronouncing on an organism that's like, 4 billion years old or so. Okay. Well, the second one was Buckminster Fuller, and Bucky said this great thing. He said, we're like bees, you see. Bees who go out looking for honey without realizing that we're also performing cross-pollinization. So, and then this third thing sort of showed up, which people have been saying, well, you know how life probably started here is bacteria came from another planet and then sort of started, seeded the Earth, and then life forms evolved from that moment on. The interesting thing is that in looking at the relationship with pollinators and pollination, there's this been kind of innovation that Gaia has gone through for a long time, from wind pollination to pollinator pollination, which is a lot more efficient. And the interesting thing is that all of the spacecraft that we're sending into space, all the ones that we've sent to every other planet, every moon, all out into the galaxy, all of those are filled with various bacteria and viruses. And they've found that those bacteria and viruses, they can live in space for a long, long time. They found them in spacecraft that went to the moon and were visited, and they found the bacteria on them, brought them back, and they regenerated immediately. The Mars lander that's up there has at least 11 bacteria that they've identified that are still there. And when you realize that Gaian seeding, that it takes, you know, 500 million to a billion years for a planet to, for that life to develop, you're basically looking at this tremendously innovative seeding process that's occurring. And it's not that different than if you look at the way plants are. You know, when they grow, they come out of the winter, and then they grow, and they've stored up all these nutrients, and they begin producing seeds, and the seeds are sent out into the world. And at that point in time, the plant begins to look a bit ragged because it's using up stored resources. And in many respects, that's what we've been doing. We've been using up stored planetary resources basically to send things into space. We think we're going around looking for information when actually what we're doing is performing cross-pollinization.
It reminds me of a Vonnegut novel or something, but it's fascinating. I want to let listeners know again, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. This is the Recovery Zone, and today's guest is Stephen Herod Buhner, a senior researcher at the Foundation for Gaian Studies and author of Plant Intelligence and the Imaginal Realm, Beyond the Doors of Perception into the Dreaming of the Earth. And if you'd like to call in with a question or two, you can phone 503-231-8187. Just to get back a little more, well, maybe two things about the bacteria again. One thing about these bacteria that I got was that they're incredibly cooperative. It's like the intelligence of a bacteria is that there's a loose rogue bacteria out there, all the bacteria might do it in or something.
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Selfish bacteria are actually prohibited from taking over. You know, so one of the things I thought was hilarious is they actually prosecute the bankers, you know, and we don't.
Right.
So really, which one is the most intelligent species?
Right.
You know, but the bacteria actually they make cities. They actually generate electricity. Bacterial colonies at the bottom of the ocean make electrical cables that look exactly like ours. They're just much smaller. And they use temperature and pressure differentials to create electricity to warm their cities. They engage in really sophisticated tool making and tool use. They have culture. They have a very sophisticated language. And they're extremely cooperative with each other. It's like they're really sort of this membrane that goes around the planet, and they work very industriously to maintain the homeodynamics of the planet. That's one of the major things they do.
And another little side issue was that the SRIs, the serotonin reuptake inhibitors that we're dumping all over the place, might be having some kind of an effect.
It's not might. They're having a major effect, because once you understand that serotonin is the regulator for the neural networks of the planet, then most people don't understand. In amongst my liberal tribe, it's extremely common that even though they're very concerned about pesticide use and agriculture and pollutants in the environment, one of the things that's not recognized is that pharmaceuticals that humans use are not very biodegradable. Many of them won't biodegrade at all, except under very special circumstances. So when we take an antibiotic or any other kind of pharmaceutical, the reason why we have to keep taking it is because our body, we take it and our body goes, oh my God, what's this thing? And our body excretes it out into the environment. So we have to keep building up the levels of the pharmaceutical to have it do whatever it's supposed to do in our body. That stuff gets excreted mostly into the water supply through the toilets, and it goes out into the ecosystem. Water plants do not filter those things out, and they continue to affect all life forms, since all life forms are so similar, forever, wherever they go. It stimulated this massive alterations in the functioning of the planet, which is a great deal more dangerous than global warming, by the way. And so, you know, that the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, in which massive numbers are going into the ecosystem, are affecting the neural networks wherever they go. And so, for instance, are probably the three major bad ones are those, antibiotics, and hormones, like hormone replacement therapy, estrogens that are going out, because these things become active in altering physiology of the planet at about one part per trillion in the water supply, which plays havoc with toxicology assessments, because most people assume 1 or 10 parts per trillion is not enough to get changes, but actually more alterations occur at 10 parts per trillion than at 1 part per 100.
Wow. Well, and then to get back to the feeling part of it, like SRIs, like Prozac is one, for instance. And a friend of mine had terminal cancer with only a few months left to live. And we were there when the doctor was telling her that he wanted her to start, you know, he was asking her why she wasn't taking her Prozac that he had prescribed. And she said, no, she didn't want to take it. She wanted to feel what this was going to be like, this whole dying process. And his only response was something like, well, why would you want to do that? You know? And
That statement kind of sums up what's the problem with American medicine right there.
Yeah, and your book over and over again talks about how we are really meant to feel. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about that.
Rilke said this great thing, which I particularly love. He goes, not only do people nowadays not live their own lives, they don't live their own deaths, which has been a really great meditation for me. I think that woman was tremendously brave to take that step. The thing is, I quote the Kalahari Bushmen quite a bit in this book, and there is this great phrase that where this one woman said, do people in America keep bumping into feelings that they don't know the meaning of? Do they keep telling their hearts to go back to sleep every day? And the answer is, of course, yes. There's a quality of every physical object that we encounter, and we access the quality of those things by how they feel to us. Now, everybody's had the experience of walking into a restaurant, one they've never been to before, and they say, hey, let's go try this new one. They get there, they walk in, and everybody does this. They sort of just stand inside the door for a minute, and even though they're not conscious of what they're doing, they're basically going, how does it feel here? And if it feels weird, everybody's had the experience of like, ooh, this place feels kind of weird, let's leave. Mm-hmm. So that's exactly what I'm talking about. It's very different than emotion. It's basically the sensory capacity of the heart. As James Hillman put it, he said, you know, we have lost the response of the heart to what's been to what's presented to the senses. And it's basically reclaiming the response of the heart to the touch of the world upon us. And that one thing alone gives access to the different kind of thinking Einstein was talking about. He was really clear that the rationality, the brain analysis, it was useful as a tool, but without the response of the heart to the world, it was not only useless in the long run, it was very dangerous. And, you know, I continually have been making the point in all of my work for a very long time that the most subversive act any of us can engage in is to reclaim our capacity to feel, to ask ourselves every day, how does this hospital feel? How does this doctor feel? How does this pharmaceutical feel? How does this restaurant feel? How does this house feel, this chair, this friend? How does this word that this person told me feel? Because the feeling sense gives us incredible amounts of information about the nature of the things, the deeper meanings in the things that we're encountering. It's very much like the sense of taste. And I quote Alice Walker in there about sense of taste, where she said, when the first black grandmother in Alabama said her greens tasted like water, then the entire country should have ground to a halt, because one of the ways the world tells us about things that are dangerous to us is that they begin to taste funny. Only now we've eaten poison food by the ton. We've also continually to eat poisoned feelings by the ton, because we don't pay attention to the feeling, our feeling self, and then the deeper meanings in what we encounter. There's a reason why people feel like their life is meaningless and why they end up on Prozac, and it's for exactly this reason.
And you talk, too, about these huge packets of information, which is sort of basically, I get the sense, how Gaia operates, that comes through the feeling sense. For instance, you talked about maybe putting a little more funk into a jazz song, and you just can use one little word for that, but the person playing the jazz song has a whole kind of gestalt that they're able to put into it that people either get is happening or isn't happening. But that there's a lot of information that gets to us that way.
There's massive. And one of the few places that people still interact with it is in music, because music is filled with feeling. It's not just sound. We've all probably heard a musician play who wasn't putting feeling into the music, and it just sounded sort of flat, or something was kind of wrong with it. So musicians that really know what they're doing, when they're playing, they have to feel every note. And there's a kind of a particular sophisticated feeling, a linguistics of feeling that they put in there. They're communicating in a way that bypasses the linear mind. It goes directly to the deepest parts of us, the parts of us that still feel, and they communicate certain things to us that when we take those meanings in, that conversation, it actually helps heal damaged hearts in many different kinds of ways, because it reconnects us to this communication of feeling that we're generally divorced from most of the time. That language that musicians use, they have to speak in metaphor, because there's not a very sophisticated linguistics of feelings or meanings that are held inside the feelings of notes. So they might say, put some funk in it, or this one's got to be more nasty, or get down on this one, or whatever they say. But most of them will know exactly what you're talking about when you do that. And it's one of the very few areas where Americans have any access to the feeling experience at all anymore.
And it's a way of sort of beginning to override that gating that keeps us at the surfaces. And you also talked about, say, the potential for, there is an interesting part of your book about hallucinogens and then schizophrenics and people with more open gates. We consider them crazy, but in another culture, they might actually be shamans. Could you talk just briefly about that?
Yeah, the interesting thing is that anybody that has gating channels open beyond the norm, and the norm in America is extremely narrow, but they begin to have an experience, they begin to literally perceive a lot of stuff that most people don't perceive, and they don't really know what to do with that. So, I mean, gifted children, artists, and of course schizophrenics, there's a lot of people, Buddhist masters, people that meditate, they all have very widely open gating channels. The thing is that when you compare the dynamics of gating channels to, or the sensory gating and how it's open and the experience of schizophrenics, it's identical to that of people on hallucinogens, and it's identical to people like Buddhist masters that do a lot of deep meditation. So the interesting thing is about 10%, 12% of the population gets sort of thrown up in this way. They emerge out of the population with this very much more open gating dynamic, and that's about also the same amount of people that want to take hallucinogens in any culture. But the problem is that people that are labeled schizophrenic are labeled as being ill, whereas in other cultures, they would be recognized for having these very widely open gating channels, which allowed them access to the metaphysical background of the world, and they would then be trained to use that facility for the good of the community. We just don't have a niche for it. And so those people, rather than being trained and helped to use that capacity, they're told that they're crazy, they're heavily medicated to try to narrow the gating channels. And even the ones that know there's something important in what's happening, the problem is there's very little literature, there's very little metaphor or story that they're able to find to explain what's happening to them so that they can understand it. So, you know, not only are they crazy, their caretakers are most often very crazy themselves, because they're holding on to this very Western narrow American perspective of perception. And literally, schizophrenics really do perceive things that are really there. It's just they don't know how to sort it out and what to do with it.
It's pretty incredible. I just want to let listeners know again, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. This is the Recovery Zone, and today's guest is another person here trying to help us heal our world, Stephen Herod Buhner. He's a senior researcher for the Foundation for Gaian Studies, and we're talking about his book, Plant Intelligence in the Imaginal Realm, Beyond the Doors of Perception into the Dreaming of the Earth. If you'd like to call in, the number here is 503-231-8187. And there are two little other parts to this. You talked about a kind of a golden thread that if we did want to start working with our feelings and stuff, we start hooking into a sense of congruence. We start hooking into a sense of actually being a part of the family of all the beings on this planet, a part of the environment. But it's following this golden thread. Could you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, golden thread actually came from something, again, that William Blake said, and the poet William Stafford, who I admire tremendously, he took that and developed it, and then Robert Bly played with it as well, quite a bit as well. But basically the way it works is that if you have your feeling sense, if you're using your feeling sense and you're extending it to the world and you're letting the world touch you and you're feeling all of the things that are around you, every so often something will capture your attention. It's like there's something about it that seems out of the ordinary, and that's what both Blake and Stafford referred to as a golden thread or a golden string. And then, you know, James Hillman has a nice word about it. He said this is called notitia, the active noticing of the soul. It gets your attention and you begin to focus on the thing and you begin feeling more deeply into it and you sort of just begin following it where it goes. You let the natural wonder and interest of your childlike self respond to it to find out where it goes, what it's for, why it captured your interest. And Stafford was great. He said, and as I do that, things not remotely in my awareness would suddenly just emerge as if the string were connected to all of these other things in the environment. And actually, in fact, it's true. You know, John Muir said this great thing. He says, when you pull on any one thing, you find it connected to everything else in the universe. This concept of these threads of connection, it's prevalent in all ancient cultures. The Kalahari talk about it tremendously. They call it a tapping, that you'll be going along and all of a sudden you'll feel a tapping, like the thread is tapping on you, saying, look, over here, follow me. So when we begin to live a life filled with that kind of feeling and filled with the meanings that we can have access to like that, and we begin to follow these threads or these tappings when they touch us, our life becomes tremendously rich, and we begin to find information and understandings and insights and experiences that can really be found no other way. We basically begin engaging the mystery of the world that we live in, the mystery of what life really is, of this scenario in which we're embedded, and it becomes just a tremendous adventure. And Einstein, Barbara McClintock, Goethe, all of the people that I've talked about in my works, every one of them said this is how they found all of the things they found, how they did the work they did. Barbara McClintock specifically said, I never went any place that the corn did not first tell me to go. And she ended up winning the Nobel Prize for her work with corn transposons. And people, you know, said, oh, I just don't like her mysticism. And she said, you don't understand, this isn't mysticism. This is real science. This is how it really works.
We do have two callers. Dennis, would you like to just briefly ask your question, because we're getting low on time?
Okay, this has to do with science. You know, and I'm going to talk about briefly about some research of a friend of mine who is a physicist, and he, you know, he was interested in the fact that we have in you know, humans, we have circulation of the blood, and he wondered about this kind of circulation in plants, and in particular, we have the idea of xylem and phloem You know, xylem just goes up. The stuff goes up and phloem goes down. And he wondered why the xylem, you know, how that worked. And he worked out a theory for it. Now, I don't, and he thinks that that's the first time anybody did that. Now, I don't know about that, but that's what he says.
That's basically what Gregory Bateson called a meta pattern, that the kind of circulatory dynamics that occur there. Plants predate the human species by quite a while, and they predate mammal species and many animal species by quite a while. So once Gaia discovers a pattern like that, Gaia begins to use it in further emergences all of the time, so that when you begin to look at the world and at everything, you find the similarity of patterns that are everywhere, because we're not really that, none of us are really that different from any other life form.
Okay, but what I wanted to say is this man, whose name is Kern Kenyon, K-E-N-Y-O-N, this is a he gave a scientific explanation. I mean, so there's, in addition to the Gaia explanation, he has given a scientific explanation of this thing, which is similar to the circulation of the blood, which William Harvey discovered long ago. Okay, that's my comment. Okay,
thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
One thing I really loved from the book about, and as you just mentioned, patterns, was that you have some pictures on the back of it where they've taken whale songs and made them kind of into a 3D image, and it turns out they look like these big, beautiful flowers. And it just seems like the whole sense of pattern is just running through everything from, the universe down to, like, the tiniest little one-celled atom sort of thing, and life is in between all that.
Well, one of the things that I talk about is Native American medicine people consistently said that all plants have a song, and that, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is that there's different maps through, or lenses through which you can view the world that we're immersed in, and each map is useful for some things. And one of the maps that is rarely used but is tremendously interesting is looking at the world as a musical expression, because there's vibratory patterns that are ongoing here all of the time. So I found it fascinating that whale song, when it's done in a three-dimensional image like that, looks exactly like certain kinds of flowers. Dolphin song does too, bird song does too. And what's interesting is that when you then compare Native American song from, you know, the late 1800s, early 1900s, a lot of these were recorded by Francis Densmore, really remarkable work, that the songs of the plants, you can find a plant very similar to the whale and dolphin song, and actually the songs are incredibly similar. So, you know, and basically Kathleen Harrison commented once, she said, you know, these songs represent on the sonic level the same things that seeds represent on another, which is just a tremendous insight that she had. So that's kind of a dimension of the world that isn't much looked at, and I explored it to a certain extent in the book. Yeah.
And talked about, like, synesthesia and how we can actually blend our senses to kind of pick up on all that. But we do have another caller, Joanne.
Yes, hello. I've only been listening to the program for a short time. But one of the questions that has entered my mind is you were having calling the people schizophrenic who have this ability but don't know what to do with it. And so I'm thinking, are these people that teach in universities and colleges mental health or psychology in that for people to become psychiatrists, whatever, psychologists, do they know about this? And do they teach it to the students? Also, another question entered my mind. Are these people, as I said, I only listened to the program a short time.
And we're running out.
Are these people that have this special ability and don't know what to do with it, can they develop things in their physical body because of this, and that, like fibromyalgia and that? I'll get off the phone and listen.
Okay. A lot of people in the universities do know about sensory gating dynamics. It's just that they have a very human-centric orientation about things, And they're basically, if they start saying we can train all of these people as holy people and shamans, then their funding is going to be cut off. They know what side their bread's buttered on, and that I see that over and over again in my research. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it sounds like there just needs to be more kind of, I mean, I'm sure they think oftener, people think that this sensory gating is a good thing, you know, as opposed to maybe something that's closing us off from the planet and our life here.
One of the first things that happens when you open sensory gating is the boundary between self and other thins. You begin to be able to see other life forms from their own point of view, and that's one of the crucial dynamics involved in it.
Yeah, in fact, I think basically by the end of your book, there's a sense of really that what's most important is that we start developing a sense of empathy for life, a sense of empathy for this environment that we're in. Maybe just sort of talk about that just briefly.
It's extremely important. I mean, everybody talks about wanting to save the planet. Not that the planet needs saving. We need saving. Our culture needs saving, I guess. But the thing is that without a tremendously well-developed empathic sense, we remain careless. If you don't have the capacity to care with the heart and bond with other things and see them as merely another variety of life form like yourself, we will remain careless indefinitely, and that there is no escaping that fundamental truth.
So how would you see someone being an activist then from this whole perspective?
Well, one of the points I make in this book is that the real solution is not going to be these top-down experts saying everybody should do this, everybody should do that. I mean, we've been running around. First we had plastic bags to save the trees. Now we're having paper bags to save the oceans from plastic. And the viewpoint is too narrow. Gaia depends upon the individual genius of every life form on the planet and basically sends an impulse through the system whenever there's a problem, and that impulse goes through the system, and then the individual incredibly intelligent life organisms that are in that area, they begin to generate solutions to the problem out of their own genius. That's what we need to do. And, you know, one of the points I make is in the book is there were these researchers trying to find out how an AIDS protein, you know, folded, and they spent 10 years and millions of dollars on it, and they couldn't solve the problem. So they were about to close down, and one of the guys had an idea. Hey, let's put it on the internet and open it up to the gaming community. Within a week, there were like 50,000 people working on it, and they solved the problem in 10 days.
10 days.
And that's the reason why experts are the reason we're in this mess to begin with. And I'm a big fan of individual innovation and genius and trusting the individual to find solutions. That's how every great innovation has occurred. It has not occurred in laboratories from these guys who think they know everything.
Yeah, and so ultimately, your book is about trusting too then, trusting Gaia herself and really seeing her as a person to have empathy with or a being or whatever, and then trusting the life forms that are all here and trusting our own hearts. I mean, that's sort of...
Very much so. We have, each of us has an individual work set before us. You could even call it our ecological function. Gaia has to deal with the big picture. There's no human being smart enough to deal with the big picture. The best we can do is do our own part of it and have faith and trust in the larger thing. As Goethe once said, I trust myself to nature. She may do as she will with me. And that is true environmentalism.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. So do you have any last thoughts that you'd like to leave then with the KBOO listener? We have maybe a minute left.
We know less than 1% of anything that's going on the planet. And the important thing is really to trust your own heart, your own feeling perception, and to trust that still small voice in the depths of you that knows what it is that you must do. And that is the way out of the predicament we're in. We can't use the old rationality reductive orientation, which is a big part of the problem, that we're facing, we have to do a different kind of thinking, as Einstein said. And that different kind of thinking is a thinking with the heart first. The brain is only plays a supportive role.
Yeah, thinking the way the world thinks, thinking the way Gaia thinks.
That's right.
Yeah. And thinking with these patterns, with this richness, with these incredibly complex. Anyway, it was a fascinating book.
Thank you.
And so I want to thank you, Stephen, for being on this show. Just let the listeners know that you've been hearing from Stephen Herod Buhner, that's B-U-H-N-E-R, a senior researcher for the Foundation for Gaian Studies and the author of Plant Intelligence in the Imaginal Realm. This has been the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter. Thanks to Tammy for her fine engineering, and thank you for listening.
It's 12 noon, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from B-Space Movement and Expressive Arts Studio, hosting the Life Art Being Integrative Arts Festival. It's a festival of practicing presence with the self, the body, and earth, July 7th through 12th at B-Space and Portland Shambhala Center. Life Art Being includes authentic movement, Shambhala art, deep ecology practices, and more. Information at B-Space. Hello. No. At b-space.org/lifeartbeing. And thanks for tuning in this morning to KBOO programming. We're going to move on to jazz in a few moments, but we've got the noon news headlines to bring you, so stay tuned for that. KBOO Portland.